Chapter 71. Molly had called him before he'd even made it out of the front gate of the Wickham estate, with the name of the retired cop who had led the investigation into the missing Hangman's Sonnet master tape. "His name's James Flint, and he lives on Mayflower Way in Swan Harbor." Tamara Elkin lived in Swan Harbor, but in a different part of town. 311 Mayflower Way was a brick colonial only a few blocks from the Atlantic, in an older part of town than Tamara's condo. All the houses on the street were fronted by hand-built stone walls and surrounded by big old oaks and maples. Jesse parked in front and walked up the entrance. The front door swung open even before Jesse was halfway to the small granite stoop. A tall but bent man, his hair a wiry steel gray, stepped out and called to Jesse.
"Chief Stone, walk around back. I'll meet you out there."
Flint retreated back inside as Jesse veered to his right and made his way around back. There was a small cedar deck butted up against the house. There was a picnic-style table on the deck. On the table, a pitcher of iced tea and two glasses. As Jesse was sitting down, Flint came out the back door, carrying a thick, dark brown accordion file in his left arm.
"Chief," Flint said, shaking Jesse's hand, "I'm Jimmy Flint. Please call me Jesse." "Yeah, I suppose it's better than us calling each other Flint and Stone."
Flint poured out the iced tea.
"Means we can skip the Fred and Barney jokes."
The left corner of Flint's lips turned up in what passed as a smile.
"Officer Crane tells me there's a break in the case," he said, thumping the accordion file down on the table.
"See for yourself." Jesse unfolded a copy of the sonnet and slid it over to the old cop. Flint shook his head.
"I tell you what, Jesse, there were many times I didn't believe the damn poem existed.
But there it is."
"That it is."
"I've held the original in my hand. But what made you say that about not believing the poem existed?"
"Look, Jesse, the Yarmouth PD isn't exactly the FBI or the Boston PD. And I suppose it was even less of a force back in the mid-70s when I worked the case. But Jester wouldn't even talk to us. It was all Stan White, the manager. White said there were no copies of the poem because Jester wouldn't let copies be made. So we had nothing to go on there. And no one other than White and Jester had seen it."
Jesse asked about the tape.
"Yeah, we had the box the tape was stored in. Here."
Flint reached into the file and produced several faded color photos of an empty plastic box.
"The prints on the box were Jester's, White's, and Evan Updike's."
"The engineer. That's who I'm interested in," Jesse said.
"What an asshole. I liked him for it. We all did."
"But?"
"But there was no hard evidence against him. All of their prints were all over the damn studio. No one saw him take it. We executed warrants on his room and on his car. We even kept him under surveillance until he left Cape Cod. We knew exactly what we were looking for, too."
Flint pulled out another faded photo. This one was black and white. It was a shot of Terry Jester, a much younger Stan White, and a man Jesse assumed was Evan Updike, holding a reel of tape toward the camera. The top side of the reel faced the camera. On one of the wide metal spokes of the reel was a piece of masking tape, and on the masking tape was written, "The Hangman's Sonnet Master," in black marker. White and Updike were smiling, but Jester's expression was flat and distant.
"That Updike there?"
"Yep," Flint said. "A nasty piece of work, that one. Must have been a hell of an engineer for people to put up with the bastard."
"Seems he had that effect on everyone. I never met the man, and I don't like him."
"So, Jesse, do you really think this is it? Is the tape going to resurface after all these years?"
Jesse explained the details about where Kernet's body had been found, about Updike being Maud Kane's nephew, about how he'd rented a room from her in the period of time after the tape went missing, and about Roscoe Niles receiving the original poem at the station.
"I'd appreciate a call if and when the tape's recovered. This damn case has kept me up nights on and off for 40 years. Be nice to know for sure before I kick."
"It's a promise," Jesse said, shaking Flint's hand.
Flint pushed the accordion file toward Jesse.
Here, take this. Been nothing but a damned albatross to me all these years. Hope it ain't one for you, son.
Jesse hoped so, too. Chapter 72 Hump knew it was late when he cracked his lids open, but he was still tired and fell back into that nether space between waking and sleep. Trapped inside since he'd come to Boston, moving only at night from place to place, he'd had very little option but to eat and watch TV in the shithole apartments of the men who'd been willing to put him up for the night. Overeating made him lazy and fat, and he found that all he wanted to do was to escape into sleep. That morning it was especially bad because he was stressed and up against it. He was running out of time and options. He was already taking stupid chances by staying with the last two guys he'd asked to put him up for a night. He had iffy relationships with both of them. 2 days ago, it was someone he knew as a kid, but not exactly a friend and not a person he had a whole lot of faith in. Still, it had worked out. He'd thrown the guy $200 and asked him to forget he'd ever been there. Yesterday, he'd taken a much bigger risk, staying at Milo Burns's dump. Milo was a full-on tweaker, the kind of guy who'd steal anything from anyone and worry about consequences and the swag's worth afterward. That's how he'd ended up inside with Hump and King in the first place. Hump was quickly falling out of the in-between world and back into sleep, his body relaxing as he fell. Somewhere in his head, he thought he was at the beginning of an unpleasant dream. It was a dream of noises and odors, of a squeaking door hinge, creaking floorboards, the gentle rustling of fabric against fabric. It stank of old sweat and smoke. It didn't take long for Hump to decipher that the stench and the noises were coming not from dreamland, but from Milo Burns rifling through his stuff. If Hump had been fully awake, there'd be no contest between a skinny, decayed weasel like Milo Burns and himself. Hump had been horrified at the sight of Burns when he'd come through his apartment door the night before. The guy's skin was a sickly yellow. His teeth were rotting out of his head, and he looked like a walking skeleton. Hump opened his eyes just enough to get a sense of what was happening, but he was facing a wall, his back to Burns. Hump had his nine in bed with him, and his cash was in a bag taped to the inside of his left thigh. The ring, though, was in one of his bundled-up socks. He couldn't let a scale like Burns get to it. Hump rolled around, tossing the moth-eaten sheet off him, raising the 9mm toward Burns. "What the fuck, Milo, you piece of—" But he couldn't finish the sentence, because Burns had come armed, too, and plunged a serrated kitchen knife into Hump's belly. Hump reached out with his left hand, grabbing onto Burns' sweat-soaked T-shirt that hung off the tweaker like a tent. He pulled Burns close to him, put the muzzle of the gun into the flat of the bony man's abdomen, and fired. He fired again. Again. The third bullet went right through the bag of bones and skin and into the wall of the closet-sized bedroom. Some of the noise was swallowed up by Burns' now lifeless body. Hump tossed the almost weightless dead man aside like an old foam pillow. Ears ringing, lightheaded, he stood. When he did, he collapsed back onto the bed. He noticed his shirt was slowly turning red, soaking with blood, and that the kitchen knife was still stuck in his belly. He laughed at his situation, wincing in pain as he did. The knife was going to have to come out, and when it did, it was going to hurt like a bastard. That wasn't the worst of it. He knew that when he pulled it out, the serrated edge would do more damage and the bleeding would get much worse. Hump forced himself to get up again, tossing the gun down on the bed. He found his way into the filthy bathroom, going through the cabinets for anything that might work as an antiseptic, for gauze or cotton, anything he could use to staunch the wound, and tape to hold the makeshift bandage to the wound. What he found in the bathroom was some cotton wadding and toilet paper, nothing else. In Burns's room, he found a syringe Milo had readied for himself and a pint bottle of cheap vodka with a few swallows left inside. Hump took a swig of vodka,
tied off his left biceps with the piece of rubber tubing Milo had meant to use for himself, poured a stream of vodka onto the syringe, and then stuck the needle into a bulging vein at the bend of his left arm. The jolt was immediate, intense. Hump's whole body clenched, his eyes widened. The noise on the street below turned into the buzzing of a million mosquito wings. In a single motion, he tore his shirt off as if it were made of tissue paper. Strangely, what had frightened him so only a few seconds before, the thought of yanking the knife out of his gut, now seemed like something he couldn't wait to try. Without hesitating, he grabbed the knife's handle, took a few deep breaths, and pulled. He collapsed to his knees, the weirdest thought going through his head. Is this what getting hit by lightning feels like? Lightning always frightened him. As bad as the pain was, it almost felt like it was happening to someone else. When he managed to get to his feet, Hump realized he was still holding the knife. He laughed at it, dropped it. He noticed the blood was now pouring out of him and onto his pants. He poured the remainder of the vodka onto the wound, lightning striking a second time. Then he wadded up the cotton and shoved it into the mouth of the wound. He covered the cotton with sheets of toilet paper and pressed his hand hard against it. He found Milo's meth stash and pocketed it. Hump went back into his room, rigged strapping out of some torn shirts, changed the bandage, and used the strapping to hold the new bandage to the wound. He got into different jeans, threw on a shirt, and in spite of the heat, a sweatshirt over that. He wiped off the bloody gun on the bedsheet, tucked it at the small of his back, and grabbed the baggie of meth out of his old jeans. He thought about taking his duffel bag with him, but decided not to try it. He had to travel light and move fast. Instead, he collected the pair of socks in which he'd hidden the dragonfly ring. He had no choice now. He had to get to Dennis's place and find Mickey Coyle.